From theunce.com, this is The Unce Podcast. Featuring artist interviews, unreleased tracks, and previews of the biggest events in electronic music. Available every week at theunce.com. Gone, gone, gone indeed. Hello and welcome to the Unce Podcast. I'm your host, Anand Harsh. The New Deal is going, going, gone. For the past decade, they've fused the jam and electronic worlds with their improvised live breakbeat and house. From their home in Toronto to their major success in New York City and across the states, the New Deal is responsible for introducing dance music to a whole new generation of fans, and they really left their mark on what is a vastly different scene. My guest today is Dan Kurtz, bass player for the New Deal, and as the trio wraps up its decade-long career at the end of this month and into the next, we also take a look at Kurtz's new project, Dragonette, which achieved phenomenal success this past year with a track I know all of you have heard and has probably gotten stuck in your head. We've had your bandmate Darren Shear on the show a couple of times now, and we've really gotten the sense of how his musical upbringing and training has carved out a path for him and really set the stage for who he is as a drummer. Let's get into your background a little. First of all, was the bass your first instrument?
No, I think it was my third instrument.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think like most bass players, I started playing bass because I wanted to be in a band and every other instrument was taken. And so
sure.
I think that was the Paul McCartney story, or like, oh, well, somebody's got to play bass, so I'll do it. And so, but anyway, it turned out to be the most enduring of the instruments I've played so far. It's been great.
Were you classically trained? Did you start off on piano or move to guitar or
yeah,
even
I started on the violin.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. I was thinking about that the other day. My nephew has my violin now, and he's 2, and it's about his size, I think. So it's been a while.
So you've got a pretty solid foundation in theory and composition and all that.
To some degree, I think that it doesn't really, whatever I may have learned, like whatever theory I learned playing violin, which is actually kind of indirectly learned through that, I don't think was anything I or any of us, or Jamie and I, definitely like the kind of chordal melodic guys, ever applied to the New Deal. Only that I think you just get used to harmonic relationships that I guess you've listened to for a long time as a kid, and those are the things that you are attracted to. I think if you listen to the body of the New Deal work, there's a lot of classical movements in there. And I just think it's probably, you know, Jamie started on the piano, I started on the violin. It's just the things that I guess are resonate with you. And so I guess in an indirect, informal way, then yeah, the theory probably helped.
So you and Jamie have known each other the longest then. Did you actually come up together in the scene there in Toronto?
Kind of. We started in high school together. I don't actually, yeah, Jamie joined the band that I started as the shitty bass player. Mm-hmm. And he was like the guy who all of us were like totally blown away. Oh my God, this guy can play every single Pink Floyd tune like perfectly on his keyboard. And
which is all that's important at that age.
Yeah, totally. And so he and I played together in high school, and then we went to different universities. And then when he came to my university, we kind of started up a band again. And after the dissolution of that not so great band, Jamie went on in Toronto for a couple of years to play with this band One Step Beyond, which I think was probably his first very limited foray into the American jam band scene at the time. They played a little bit in the U.S. And so when that band ended, I asked Jamie to come and play keys in this band that I was in. And from there, it was just around then that we ended up hooking up with Darren and going and playing off on our own. It was good timing for all of us to kind of come together. I think we were all looking to do something different. And Jamie brought the awareness of the scene in the U.S., which up until that point I had never heard of. And I think Darren probably say the same. And he was like the guy who was like, oh yeah, there's this like bulletin board on the internet that I can send a couple of our tunes out to and see if people dig it. And that was the... the beginning of it. So that was how we came into the scene together, but it wasn't certainly since, you know, we weren't joined at the hip musically from high school and both discovered the same things at the same time.
That's kind of interesting. So you did have a concept that your sound would have a place in the sort of jam band world that was probably at this point, like you had mentioned, probably a Usenet forum or a bulletin board or something, you know, very, very primitive
back
at the time.
Back in the late 70s when we started, Yeah, Jamie definitely, he did think that way. And because, I mean, where he saw the similarities was like we were jamming and people would dig that whether we were doing it to a disco beat or not, you know. And I remember being like, I didn't even know what he was talking about. He was a huge Fish fan, and so that was like, I was like, oh yeah, that's in his Fish world. I had come from promoting raves in Montreal in the early 90s and was more into like the dance world, and so my thought was like, oh, I'm going to call a couple of club owners I know in Montreal and see if we can go and play, you know, to those kids out there. And so we hit what we knew, and Jamie hit this scene that he had spent a couple of years, you know, paying attention to, basically. And it worked. Like, it really worked.
Yeah, and so you were way ahead of the curve then in seeing this sort of transition, or maybe not transition, but almost a combination of these very, what you would assume is two completely distinct groups, the sort of jam ethos with your Umphreys and Cheese and Fish and all that, with this new electronic scene that is not only heavily DJ driven, but also these sort of live Tronica bands, quote unquote, that split the difference. So you saw this coming way around the pike.
Yeah, I don't know if we like saw it coming in that it was something that it was going to happen regardless and we should try and get on that horse. Like, if anything, I think we were like, this is exactly where we want to go in terms of, like, you know, what we're playing. And it just, it was amazing that we found an audience for it. And I think we shaped that audience a little bit with the music that we were playing.
Sure.
And I think, and so it almost, it was like a mutually perpetuating thing. Like, we educated the audience a little bit and then the audience kind of demanded a little bit more from us, and et cetera, et cetera. And the music evolved as lots of forces came in and changed that scene. You know, there was guys, people who are DJing between sets were moving from being like just whatever, spinning records, to guys like DJ Logic, who were bringing like hip hop into like basically a bunch of white jam kids were not used to hip hop. And that started coming in and beats and dance and all that stuff. And it just was a matter of time before it all, everything contributed, the audience and all the various artists at the time contributed to this, I think, like a leapfrog out of the strictly jam scene into what became, you know, the new standard for a while, which now is like evolved into, you know, the craziest of wicked dubstep.
That's The New Deal from their 2009 Live in Toronto album. They play their final Toronto show this Saturday at the Opera House. And so you carve out your niche in the jam and electronic worlds. You have this loyal following. You're you're set to become legendary and take on a life of their own. And then, as you mentioned, in the mid-2000s, you meet Martina Sabara, and Dragonette, or at least the initial groundwork for Dragonette, is laid. Tell me a bit about the initial concept behind the project.
Oh, man, that was a really simple concept, which was we run the risk of being in two separate musical ventures for the rest of our young lives, and we'll never see each other. Why don't we try and do something together to kind of minimize how much that will happen? I didn't actually think that it would, you know, come at the expense of Martina doing her own thing, or which happened quite quickly, and less so with the New Deal. I mean, I've continued to play up until now with the New Deal, despite the existence of Dragonette. But yeah, Dragonette was the New Deal had taken a break at one point around 2002, because we'd kind of burned ourselves out and we were hating what we were doing. And during that time, I did have to wonder, like, what will happen if I don't play with the New Deal anymore? Like, I'm at this stage in my life, all I do is play bass guitar in the New Deal. And if the New Deal doesn't continue, I only play bass guitar. And I know a lot of bass guitar players, and they can't buy gas, much less pay rent, you know, or whatever. So what actually happened was I'm a total sucker for gimmicks and fun computer stuff, and I happened to walk into the music store in Toronto where they happened to be selling this piece of software that was an emulator of a synth that 12 years later I'm still playing with the New Deal, and it was and I got hooked by the scale replica of the original synthesizer, now in a USB keyboard controller format, and I bought this big package, and I went home and I installed it, and the first sound that I came on, I played a line on it. It was my first real stab at playing keyboards, and I was like, whoa, I think that's kind of cool. I can't believe I can make these sounds. Like, I'd never, you know, since with lots of effects and all that shit on them still blow me away, and especially coming from a monophonic bass guitar, it was like, holy God, this is the coolest thing. And so that sound turned out to be the beginning of this song that I very gingerly asked Martina to try and write a vocal over in a very kind of oblique way of asking her to, let's try and write something together. Mm-hmm. And that song and the next song that we wrote together got us this record deal inexplicably in the UK. And it was the first pop song I'd ever written, and it was the first thing we'd ever done together. And it was pretty encouraging. It was like, you know, it's kind of the seminal Dragonette song. And it was enough to think like, wow, this is an adventure that we can't possibly turn down. Like, within a year, we were, you know, in talks with the record company, and we had gone on tour with Duran Duran, and we had done all this stuff. And it was fucking hilarious. Like, especially from the perspective of someone who had played a lot of shows up at that point and had some pretty good success with the New Deal. I was like, well, relative to what I know, this thing is like on a rocket ship to Mars. Like, this is a pretty amazing trajectory. And so that was the beginning. It was, again, kind of an accident spawned by my love of gimmicks and buying little bits of gear. It would never have happened if not for that synth.
Absolutely. And you've put in years at this point of grinding it out live show after live show, these long 14, 20, 30 minute, this opus of sound with the New Deal and carving out one fan at a time your niche. And then you jump into pop land. This must have been a completely new sort of concept for you as a songwriter and as a performer, because, you know, it is 3 minute tunes, and it is, you know, well, you weren't even a producer up to this point.
No. And I was accidentally a producer at that time. Like, I still listen to whatever. I still feel pretty accidental about the whole thing. But the Dragonette thing, despite that very fast rise to, you know, the record deal and, you know, getting picked up in a limo at the airport kind of thing, from that point on, took on a path that's much more similar to the New Deal's experience, which is, you know, we've been slogging it out and playing a lot of shitty shows and doing a lot of things that that if you didn't feel like you didn't believe in it, you would have definitely quit by now. We've mm-hmm. kind of been around long enough that we've had some successes later, but there was some, you know, the end of that record company awesome trajectory story is that our record company didn't put out our record. They didn't, because they didn't get the playlisting that they wanted on Radio 1 in the UK. They dropped us. They wouldn't release our record anywhere else in the world. We would have been dead on our feet had we not had our we managed to retain the rights to our record in Canada, which gave us just a little teeny opportunity to keep going. And mm-hmm. from that, we've kind of risen out of those ashes to conveniently last year, some pretty monumental success with that one song that Martina did with Martin Solvig. But ever since then, the experience of Dragonette has felt incredibly like that of the New Deal, which is, you know, people who are doing it, making a living doing what they're doing, but by no means, you know, living like some giant pop star, and continuing to do it despite some pretty incredible odds and a lot of adversity that most bands, I think, encounter. It just happened. And I think if I didn't know the experience so well, I probably would have said, fuck this. But I knew that I knew that life with the New Deal already. It's been a long time. It's the only thing I really know how to do.
That quintessential Dragonette track that Dan Kurtz just plunked out is I Get Around. You heard it right there. I'm glad you mentioned those amazing collaborations with Martin Solvig, because you did, if not achieve financial success with them, certainly, and maybe not get the Dragonette brand on each of those songs, you at least have a sound that's recognizable and people can say, oh, that's Dragonette, or you know, I've seen this before, especially with Hello and Big in Japan and things like that. You know, tell me even how that happened, because that seems like probably, I guess, the theme of this show is happy accidents.
Yeah. Well, that was so the studio that I'm sitting in right now is a happy accident coincidence, or the fact that I'm here is a direct result of all of that. I'm here mixing the third Dragonette album right now with the guy who was the engineer on Hello and a couple of the other Martin tracks, and so all of this rewinds to a point where Dragonette was the, you know, third last on a bill in some festival in Australia, and Martin Solvig was third from the top on the same bill. And we met him on the shuttle bus to the airport in Sydney, and he was like, hey, you guys are Dragonette. Yeah, I really like what you do, and I was thinking maybe we could do something together. And he's like, so I'll call you. And, you know, the number of times you hear that is a load, like, it's just too many to mention. And like,
sure, Martin, 3 weeks thank
later,
you very much.
Yeah, great. Awesome. Cool, man. But 3 weeks later, he had a track for Martina to come sing on. And from there began this great collaboration between Martina and Martin. My participation in it has been limited to working with Martina on some of her, like, she's recorded a lot of her vocals at her house in London. I get to be in the room on that. I've played bass on a couple of things with them and whatever, but it's been a really great, they have a great working relationship. And I think whether it, up until now, it's been Martina singing on tracks with Martin or them co-writing stuff that's on Martin's record. But then from two different angles, they ended up writing a song for this British pop star recently and blah, blah, blah. Like it seems like it's something that's going to continue, which is great. It's had a monumental impact on us just in terms of the profile of what Dragonette means around the world. Like we played this year in the Philippines, in Dubai, in Beirut, in Paraguay, Costa Rica, Puerto Rico, all over the US, all over Europe. And you play the first 4 seconds of that song, Hello, and people go insane. Like we walked on stage somewhere in Florence. I thought we were told we were going to play a TV show, Dragonette was. And so I thought we were going to do like these other Italian TV shows that you walk into a kind of a TV studio audience and there's 50 people there and dancing girls and somebody's talking about football teams and you and you play the song and all these go-go dancers boogie around you. And so I was prepared for that. And we showed up at the venue, and which turned out to be a giant square, and there were 40,000 people outside, and it was like the MTV Awards. Wow. And we started playing the song and people went mental, and I couldn't believe it. Like, it was the only time in my life I'd been totally stunned by what was happening. And that's the power of this one song. So who knows, maybe as we go into round two of Dragonet post Hello, that all the tunes that we're doing now will, you know, it's much more likely they won't be met with the same, you know, phenomenal success of Hello, but it'll be interesting to see what people think Dragonet means after you add this to the profile, these new songs.
Hello by Martin Solveig and Dragonette.
The new generation's music will be, it'll have a synthesis of those two elements and some third thing. It might rely heavily on electronics, tapes. I can kind of envision maybe one person with a lot of machines, tapes, electronic setups.
DDS with his homage to the end of the New Deal and civilization itself in 2012, he joins the New Deal on their December 30th show at the Highline Ballroom in New York City. Do you have maybe somewhat of a timeline for when these tunes that you're mixing down right now may reach American ears?
Oh, I would expect that they'll be in American ears kind of February, March, because I think we're going to start touring in April. So we'll definitely have them out by then. I would hope that we have those plus remixes plus, you know, I'll get a haircut and make album art, you know.
Sure.
At the moment, I look like the guy who's been trapped in a studio for 3 weeks.
I'm sure you're doing fine. So we gotta get back to the melancholy topic that brings us here. The final run is upon us. I imagine this last Toronto show is just going to be unbelievably bittersweet.
Yeah, I think, you know, to be honest, all of the, like, I thought we were never going to play New York City again after we played that Terminal 5 show that we did in May or something, and and that was tough. I think, you know, Toronto is where we started, but New York City was kind of where we were, where we grew up. Like, I think we played like, I don't know, 200 shows there or something like that.
Sure, yeah.
Playing in Toronto feels like it will be amazing to see who comes to see that show. I think beyond the fact that our probably even our moms are going to stick it out and come and see that, because it's the last chance they'll get. It doesn't feel bittersweet at all. The whole thing feels like there's been an arc to and a lifespan to what we do, and I think that we are probably best at what we do now more than at any time that we've played as a band. And mm-hmm. I think that one of the things that 8 years ago, or when it was in that hiatus period, once we got past the like, fuck this, I'm so tired of being on the road and feeling like shit and hanging out with you guys and I hate playing in the Midwest and blah 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 and all this stuff, like mm-hmm. One of the things we realized was that when we kind of overplayed what we do, which we didn't make as good music, and when we were like kind of trotting ourselves out and just like playing as much as we could to make money or build our brand or whatever it was, mm-hmm. we kind of lost what made us cool, at least to ourselves. And one of the nice things that has happened over this kind of sunset period, which I only in retrospect is a sunset period, is that the kind of fewer shows that we played, we got much better at what we do. And I think the shows are more interesting to ourselves and to other people. And I think that, you know, these last shows, I so look forward to, because they'll be really, they'll feel really different. And because there's nothing worse as a member of the New Deal than playing a run of shows that all feel the same. And we had, and I think that contributed to our feeling of like, you know, let's make this a kind of a seldom occurrence. And then we realized that it was actually impossible to maintain. Like, we couldn't keep guys on staff, and we couldn't pay all mm-hmm. the bills and do all of our visa work and all that stuff, right, and make this what was basically a hobby. But it's not a hobby because we're not serious about it. It's just that that's what musically it seemed to make the most sense. So that's a very long and kind of sideways answer to what you asked, but the thing is that I feel like this is like exactly where we're supposed to be, which is like saying goodbye to this thing that we did really well for a long time.
And then you literally get to sail off into the sunset with Jam Cruise. It's a nice totally. Coda.
Yeah, as a messy coda, if I recall the last Jam Cruise, it's like Armageddon on the water for 5 days. But yeah, we're up for it. Yeah, that'll be nice. I mean, we decided to do those shows for two reasons. One was because a lot of the guys who are kind of friends as a result of our professions crossing paths all the time, Humphreys, etc., all those guys, like most of them mm-hmm. are going to be on the boat. Sure. And we would get to hang out with them in a setting that will most likely not happen again. You know, like, you know, when I'm not going to get on a cruise ship with the New Deal and Humphreys and go and hang out with all of our wives for 5 days. It's not going to happen. So, but it's a nice way of hanging with them. And it was also a really great way of hanging with our crew who, you know, have been there. In the case of Kevin, our sound guy, Kevin has done more New Deal shows than I have. And
since the beginning. Yeah. Absolutely.
And so like, that's for us. That whole trip is all about us, our crew, and our friends, and being able to hang out with some people who are undoubtedly going to come on this thing because they want to see the last shows, and we'll be able to, it'll matter to those people that it matters to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Dan Kurtz with the New Deal and now Dragonette. We're sad to see the New Deal go, but we're excited for your new projects. Thanks so much for being on the UNS podcast.
Hey man, thanks for the opportunity to talk about it. I hadn't even thought half of these feelings until you asked the question.
I really should have people pay. This is like a psychologist's couch.
Yeah, that's right. You know what? I think I'm just going to take a long, quiet walk now and really think about what I've said.
Home from the New Deal. They'll be playing their final home show in Toronto Saturday night at the Opera House. Then it's Philly, Baltimore, and two post-Phish late night shows to close out the year in New York City. Then the New Deal plays its final show in the middle of the ocean for Jam Cruise. I'd like to thank Drew Grancelli, Kevin Park, Darren Shearer, Jamie Shields, and of course my guest, Dan Kurtz, for all the wonderful years of music. You've really left your mark on the scene, and we're all eternally grateful. We hope you'll join us tomorrow for the Unz.com second anniversary show at Temple in San Francisco with Nit Grit, DNA Beats, Freddie Todd, Gold Rush, and more. We're giving you a chance to win tickets to see Laidback Luke and win a free Ferry Corsten app, and we'll also have festival passes for the inaugural Snow Globe Festival and Lights All Night to do your New Year's right. Please visit the Unz.com for news, artist profiles, and tour dates from across the electronic music spectrum, and go ahead and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Write us a review, tell us what you think of the show. If you have any questions, comments, or complaints about the program, you'd like to be a guest on the Unz podcast, or you'd like to sponsor an episode, contact me at anand@theunz.com. That's A-N-A-N-D at theunz.com. Join the conversation at the Unz podcast on Twitter. We'll catch you next week.